Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I've always believed that necessity is the mother of invention. When I think of myself and I look at people, I'm always amazed at what it is that people manage to accomplish when they finally have to. When we don't have to, we're not terribly effective a lot of the time. When we really do have to, it's absolutely amazing what people are capable of. And we're increasingly being put in a situation where we absolutely have to build progressive mass movements and a new economy.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hanel. On this week's show, we speak to Robin about what he expects in the upcoming year and also about participatory economics and cooperative development in particular.
Someone who has been speaking and advocating for transformative change as economist, Dr. Robin Hanel. He's a professor. He's also the author of many books. And latest book is his book on participatory economics. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Hanel. Very privileged to have you on our program.
Great to be back.
Now, you know, I've been thinking about the multiple possibilities that we could engage this morning. And I think right away, perhaps the most important is to wish you a Happy New Year, since it is the beginning of the year. And with New Year's, there's always this sense of renewal, this sense of possibility, in my opinion. And I wonder if...
Well, Sylvia, there's something else people do at New Year's. They sort of look ahead to the year we're starting and sort of start to make predictions about, well, what is likely to happen. And maybe we could do a little bit of that. Because as we who are trying to make the world a better place, we need to sort of assess what we could predict, you know, will happen. As the people running the world now, you know, the course they're on, what are they likely to do, and what sort of conditions is that likely to create that then we have to figure out a strategy for responding to?
Well, you know, that's very well put, and I think let's begin there, because with the advent of New Year, there was a lot of drama around the fiscal cliff, and it seemed that it was almost you know, symbiotically aligned with the whole idea that the world was coming to an end theory.
And well, that's true. We did have that Mayan calendar thing. We're suffering some crises, and anytime human beings and human societies sense crisis, you know, then cataclysmic types of visions, you know, go through our heads. But I mean, if we look ahead, I think there's some things I feel fairly confident about in terms of, you know, what will happen over at least the next 12 months. We have an economic crisis that, you know, that started in 2008, sort of a particular economic crisis that started in 2008. And if you look forward, there's no reason to believe that it is going to somehow have a dramatic turnaround in the next year. As things are moving in Europe, in the Eurozone, as things are moving politically in the United States, with an election that really just re-elected gridlock and stagnation in terms of economic policy. We put Obama back in the White House. Well, but we know what to expect from him from the past 4 years, and that's nothing aggressive enough to really do anything serious about the economic crisis. And we unfortunately reelected the Republicans to a majority in the House of Representatives. And, you know, with the Tea Party and the scorched earth approach to we don't care if it damages people in the United States, if it's going to create greater problems and therefore get rid of the Democrat in the White House sooner, then we're willing to do anything, no matter how sort of self-destructive it is. The other thing that's going to happen is that the Chinese growth rate is going to slow down. So when you add all that together, the recessionary pressures in the global economy are likely to become worse over the next 12 months. And the reason is very simple, and that's the political conditions in the major parts of the global economy. At this point, there is no reason to believe that they are going to do the things necessary to get us out of this recession we've been in now for 5 years. The other thing that's happening is that, you know, the other major crisis is climate change. It accelerates as we do less and less, you know, that needs to be done to prevent it. There's nothing going on in the international negotiations that are to be hopeful about. We've gone from the United Nations process and a Kyoto Protocol that was calling for mutually agreed to mandatory reductions for major emitting countries. We've gone from that and a commitment to handling this problem fairly, not requiring the same sacrifices from the global south as from the global north, that's both wealthier and certainly has created, you know, bears the major responsibility for creating the problem in the first place. We've gone from that framework and, you know, up through 2009, and we are now steadily pursuing the course where we have nothing but voluntary negotiations when the major, you know, the major country governments decide that they even want to pretend they're talking to one another. And so that's what we have to look forward to. And none of that is pretty. That means that people and the environment are going to continue to suffer as we have been over the past few years. Is there a possibility that we'll have another major financial jolt? Well, since we did not have any financial reform, yes, there is. Anybody who thinks you can predict where it is that a financial crisis is going to break out and when it's going to break out really is fooling themselves, and if you listen to them, you should not be fooled. You can point to some places where it certainly could happen again. Given the fact that we had no serious regulatory reform, we could have a student debt crisis, you know, in the United States. Right now, there's a massive amount of student debt. These students are going to be unable to pay. There aren't jobs out there. That's something that could trigger the next sort of financial crisis in the United States. And, of course, in Europe, it's highly likely, or it's certainly very, very possible, that there be a Greek government default that might be followed by a Spanish government default. And that's the kind of thing that could really shake the global financial world as well. If that's what we have to look forward to, then the question is, well, what are we going to do? What do we need to do? What's going to be necessary to turn that around? And in some ways, I think the answer is the same as it's always been. We desperately need to rebuild, you know, mass progressive movements like the labor movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the peace movement. All of those movements, you know, have been seriously weakened by right-wing political forces who have taken advantage of the crisis to essentially attack progressive organizations, unions, and the welfare state in all its various forms. The 1% that created this crisis is, you know, continuing to use the crisis as a way to redo the major capitalist economies, to redo them in the form they always wanted them, which was a form that didn't have a place for a middle class, that didn't have a place, you know, for unions, that didn't have a place for decent jobs and job security. We need to rebuild the movements that are essentially fighting that battle. And I think that there are more and more people who are recognizing that we really need a whole different kind of an economy, something that a lot of people are now calling the new economy, one that's committed to sort of sustainable economic activities, locally supported institutions that aren't owned by people who can pick them up and move them as leverage in terms of demanding concessions. You know, if you don't give me this concession, I'm going to pick up and move. Well, we need to rebuild a new kind of economy where our jobs and our well-being cannot be threatened, that it's basically something we can keep. When we build things, we want to be able to make sure that we can keep them where we build them. We need to create workers-owned businesses rather than having only the choice to go work for others. So we need to do those things as always. Let me make two comments about some things that I think are a little bit different that, you know, in terms of how we go about it. I just was down at the American Economic Association annual meetings in San Diego a week ago. And I had the privilege of chairing a session that the Union for Radical Political Economists put on about co-ops, workers-owned co-ops. What do we know about workers-owned co-ops? What's the future of workers-owned co-ops? And there was some very surprising presentation. A lot of what all of us, including people on the left and progressives, think about co-ops turns out not necessarily to be true. These were some excellent presentations that had done studies of co-ops all over the world. And it turns out that co-ops are not less productive than capitalist firms, that there's strong evidence that they are actually more productive. Well, that means, well, they should be able to compete. We should be able to create co-ops to compete successfully with capitalist businesses if they're more productive. That's very good news. There's also a perception that co-ops, they only work in certain sectors of the economy, or they're only strong or exist in regions, you know, inside countries that just have a long history. And this turns out to also be something of a myth, that in fact there are many more co-ops spread throughout many more industries, you know, than most people are aware of. So one of the things we need to think about is, well, how can we build these institutions, you know, as part of our new economy? And one of the things that the studies pointed to is that part of the lack of success is simply lack of trying. That every place you have a government that is committed to helping co-ops, then you see co-ops flourishing. So sometimes it's sort of government support. You opened your show talking about Venezuela, and that's the best example in recent history of a government that made a major, major government commitment to building the co-op sector. And as a result, the co-op sector has grown tremendously in Venezuela. There's some other areas, there's some other countries where government policy has helped. And then the other area is that just having a movement, you know, of organizations that believe in co-ops and that help new co-ops coming into being. The other myth is that co-ops die faster than normal businesses. All small businesses die very quickly, and co-ops die less quickly than small capitalist businesses. So the problem isn't that when we create them, they die too fast. The problem seems to be that we simply don't create enough of them, and we don't create them quickly enough. And that's essentially sort of an organizational problem. One good thing that I notice is that if you think back historically, there was a very, very severe sort of division between the international cooperative movement and what we call the socialist movement. For, you know, well over 100 years, 150 going on 200 years, those two movements, they were very opposed to one another in a lot of ways. And I think if you now look at the way the left and co-ops work, I think that that historical division between the cooperative movement and the socialist movement has really dissipated to a great extent. And that's a very helpful and useful thing. I've been asking myself now for the past year, why has the response to this economic crisis been more tepid and less sort of successful than sort of progressive movements responding to capitalist economic crises, global crises in the past? If you go back to the 1890s, you know, up through about 1915, there was a tremendously powerful opposition movement, you know, to the evolution of capitalism in that epoch. And if you go back to the 1930s, there was a tremendously powerful growth of opposition, you know, to expanding global capitalism. I think one of the characteristics of those two periods that's been lacking, you know, for us now for really 10 to 20 years, is there was a hard core of people in those movements who completely fanatically believed that there was a better way to run our economies. So in the early 20th century, that belief was founded upon a firm conviction that once we got rid of these capitalist institutions, we could do so much better. Now, it's not that anybody ever had, but there was a firm conviction on people's part that we really do not need these capitalist owners, we really don't need this sort of system of competition and greed, we know how to do something far better. In the 30s, there was a hardcore of people who believed that we not only could do better, but we also you know, there was an example, a living example out there, really existing socialism in the Soviet Union and then in a bunch of other countries. Now, that turned out to be a myth. But I think one of the things that's been lacking in popular response to the capitalist crisis of 2008 that's going forward is we have lost a conviction that we know how to do things better, much better, and we don't need them to tell us how to do it. We don't need them at all. And that's one place where I actually think that for all the good that can come from sort of discussing and talking about how would we run an economy differently, that seems like it's so far away. Why, in the midst of crises and all sorts of campaigns that we have to be engaged in, why is it that we should spend any time sort of thinking that far ahead? I think there's a very practical reason, and that is we need to reconvince ourselves that we actually know how to do things far better, and that when there's a hard core of people working in these progressive movements, fighting these campaigns, who truly believe that and know it to be true, I think that makes us stronger. I think it makes our progressive movement, our reform movement, and our transformatory movements much more powerful. So hopefully that's the kind of thing that we look forward to, you know, doing a better job of in the year ahead.
I think that you're so right, because when I look at history, we're constantly being in this struggle to create a society that recognizes us as a full person, you know, as members of communities, as members of a family, as members who ought to be integrating the civic responsibility of that whole. And that is the struggle in Venezuela, and that is why so much media attention is being placed on the opposition and their called to bring down President Chavez while he's, you know, undergoing treatment, because they believe that if they remove the so-called leader, that the movement will end. But as you point out, if we create movements that are strengthened by a horizontal organization of power, where we are you know, reminding ourselves, we not only know how else to organize ourselves, but we can do it better. There are examples already, you know, from the diggers to the Occupy movement to the I Don't Know More movement. We see constant sparks of people wanting to create something other than. And here is where I think a shift, you know, in our spending from continuously expanding this capitalist engine of pollution and industrial pollution, we can have a shift into an ecological, participatory way of organizing our society. So let's talk a little bit about that, because that's much of your book is about what we can do better than what is being proposed today. Can we talk a little bit about your book, Participatory Economics, and where the communities such as, you know, indigenous communities here in Canada, or communities of people who are organizing to create co-ops, to create other spaces, how do they safeguard against the co-optation and corruption that inevitably will come their way by hierarchical powers who want to impose this kind of order into their organizations?
You have to create something that is local. So you create a workers' own co-op, or that's where I work now. You create, you know, community organizations that try and fight for parks and fight for, you know, and fight for funding for local schools. So we all basically fight local. And we fight the good fight local. And part of the problem is that as long as the system remains in place, these local fights are always subject to rollback. And that's where that's where the model or the idea of a participatory economy comes in. It says, let's look at all the things that we both want and actually try to do, and imagine, well, what would be an environment that encouraged and promoted these activities rather than an economic environment that essentially forced them to make concessions to sort of competition and commercial needs that really run contrary to the motivation of the people who got involved in the first place to what they want to do. It's essentially talking about, well, what would the economic system have to look like so that it encourages and it promotes dealing with each other in a cooperative and fair way, rather than every time every little group of people tries to do that, the system essentially pits them against one another and makes it more difficult for them to sort of continue to behave in the way that they realize, I want to behave this way, I know I can make it work. And that's one way to think about what this is. It's some thinking through what would the major institutions have to look like. We certainly can't allow income to be distributed, you know, through capital markets and private ownership and through labor markets, because you're not going to get fairness. When people try and treat one another fairly in their economic relations, if they do that in the context of labor and capital markets, it's impossible. Take a look at the famous cooperative, the Mondragon Cooperative in Spain. It's widely presented as an example that you can have cooperatives that compete successfully with capitalist firms. And it's an excellent example of that. It's a huge organization. It's the largest single employer in the Spanish economy. So this is certainly a successful institution. But it's been around for 40 or 50 years now. They started out with a commitment that there's no reason for us to have wage differences between our highest paid employees and our lowest paid employees that's greater than 3-1. Well, as the years have gone on, they have had to concede on that issue of what's a fair way for our members to reward one another. And they have essentially gone from 3-1 to 4-1 to 5-1 up to 7 or 8-1. Now, that's still, you know, that's nothing like the range of wages between top U.S., you know, in capitalist corporations in the United States, the CEO's wages relative to the average worker's wages. I mean, that's 1,000-1. So it's not that they're not far more fair, but as time has gone on, they've been under pressure because of the necessity of competing for employees and members with labor markets and capital markets out there in the big economy. They've been pushed in the direction of doing more and more of the things that they didn't want to do. The same thing holds for taking environmental effects into account. In the Northwest, where I live, I'm talking about Oregon and Washington, there were some famous plywood cooperatives in the 1950s and the 1960s. And they competed with capitalist plywood firms. So we had capitalist plywood firms and we had plywood cooperatives. Now, for the most part, most of those businesses, both capitalist and worker-owned cooperatives, have essentially vanished because of the collapse of the forestry industry. But if you look at exactly what happened, well, what happened was the first ones to go out of business were the co-ops that were most socially responsible. The socially responsible co-ops said, well, not only are we going to be a workers' cooperative and try and pay ourselves fairly, but we're not going to release pollutants into the Cascadian streams. We know that's bad. We know it's bad for the environment. We don't want to do it. And we are not going to buy timber from lumber companies that are engaging in clear cutting. We are going to buy our input, our timber inputs for our plywood factories. We're going to buy them from companies that engage in sustainable forestry. Well, unfortunately, that meant that they had higher costs than other plywood co-ops that were less socially responsible. So the first ones that went out of business, you know, were the more socially responsible co-ops. The second ones that went out of business were the less socially responsible co-ops. And the ones that stuck around the longest were the capitalist companies who were the most socially irresponsible in their behavior vis-a-vis the community and the environment. So those are the problems we face. And eventually, in the long run, if we want all this to work, we have to create the overall system that doesn't penalize people for behaving in socially, you know, responsible ways and reward people for behaving in socially irresponsible ways.
Well, I think that a very good place to start is to read your book, Of the People, By the People, The Case for Participatory Economics, which is now available. Tell our audience so they can access your book.
It's distributed by AK Press, which is a small libertarian socialist publishing house. You want to encourage those institutions. So the best thing to do is to go to their website and buy it through them. But, of course, it's available on Amazon, and it's available on Barnes & Noble. It's also available as an ebook. If you're somebody who now is reading on screen and you can do it more cheaply than chopping down trees that have to be chopped down to print books, then you can do it that way too. But the book mostly, I hope, will do is convince people this isn't rocket science. We don't need these Wall Street financiers to run the economy for us. That when they do so, not only do they mess things up terribly for the rest of us, but we don't really need them at all. There is no reason that ordinary people can't run their own economic affairs, but we have to think about it. We have to think about how to do it, and we have to recognize that these are problems that are arising. These are decisions that will have to be made. But what I hope more than anything else is it gives people confidence that we do not need to engage in the economics of competition and greed, that we are perfectly capable of creating a new kind of economics of equitable cooperation. Just like we know we can do it in small little environments because we do it all the time, we can make the whole economy run that way, and that's what the book's about.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. We've talked a lot about, you know, the things that we need to avoid, the things that we can do. What inspires you that we can get the job done?
We have no choice. And I've always believed that necessity is the mother of invention. When I think of myself and I look at people, I'm always amazed at what it is that people manage to accomplish when they finally have to. When we don't have to, we're not terribly effective a lot of the time. When we really do have to, it's absolutely amazing what people are capable of. And we're increasingly being put in a situation where we absolutely have to build progressive mass movements and a new economy. They're giving us no choice. And I see a lot of the beginnings of becoming more effective about this. Occupy was wonderful. Now, I know everybody says, oh, it's died out. It was a flash in the pan. That's not how these things work. It's had a lot of effect, and it just means that there'll be something else that percolates rather surprisingly, you know, in the near future. And Occupy will have played a role in making that possible. I'm very encouraged that socialists and people who believe in co-ops are no longer somehow ideologically divided. I think that's a very, very positive thing moving forward.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us and for your very timely book. Thank you again for joining us.
You're welcome, and it's great to be with you. Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care. Talk to you soon. That was Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of The People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economics.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.